My name is Chris Hoover. I'm an alcoholic. And it's good to be here. Thanks, everybody, for having me down. My home group is the Midtown Group in Bethesda, Maryland. I have a sponsor. And I'm grateful I get to sponsor other men in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's quite a privilege. And so it's quite a privilege to finally come down to this home group and see everybody here. And I've heard about it for years. I guess it sort of started when I got sober. You know, I'm about 10 years sober. Ryan's 10 years sober, almost getting there. We're in the same class. And, and I know the guys that, I know the guys well who started this home group. And they are some of the most passionate people that I know in Alcoholics Anonymous. So I only hope that everybody here that calls this their home group is trying to give that back, you know, the best that they can. And congratulations to people who picked up chips, especially the white chips. And my only hope is that you find here, in Alcoholics Anonymous, what I found, which is a life beyond, my comprehension, My vision, my perspective was so narrow coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, I had no idea how much I couldn't see and how much I really didn't know. And I hope you stick around. If it's your first time here, I hope you get a sponsor. And I hope you get busy in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was talking to Terry before the meeting, He says we get about 25 people in, two or three stay. Those are very good odds. I'm not trying to depress anyone. But very few people are willing to do what it takes. That's the truth. And I related to Brandon, who spoke earlier. I've also done a couple stints in Baltimore City Jail. And I also have urinated on light plugs, so so we have that in common. I related to him. I just wanted to party and have a good time, And I didn't ever think for one minute about the people I was hurting, the family, what my family thought. I didn't care, The way I felt was paramount over anyone else's, consideration or feelings. And I was willing to throw all that out the window. And I also relate to Brandon about that feeling of literally right before your eyes watching all of your hopes and dreams basically getting flushed down the toilet, Although Brandon had much more going for him than I did when I hit bottom, there wasn't a lot of hope and dreams going on at that point. And I started drinking probably late for some, most people. I started drinking really in earnest when I was about 17, 18, just graduating high school. And where I grew up, just outside of Washington, D.C., I had already was well acclimated with the club scene and the party scene. A lot of my friends were going to clubs. And this was, I don't mean to date myself, back in the early 90s, there was a lot of, raves and big, huge warehouse parties that people would go to. And I fell in love with it, You could go there and just do whatever you wanted, and no one really knew who you were, and you could just party your ass off, And I loved it, And that's really where I started cutting my teeth with drinking. I'm going to tell you a few stories about my drinking, but I will say this, that I absolutely love the way alcohol made me feel, my state of being before I drank was I was an anxious kid. I wouldn't say nervous, but I was uptight, I was like, I felt like there was always I always had to win. I don't know where that comes from. I felt like I always had to be in a game, and it was always a competition, and I had to be number one. I don't know where I got that, And so I was, I put a lot of that on me, and I was the kind of guy. I mean, I would go to some of these places, and they would have, pool tables, and before I started drinking, I liked to play a lot of pool, and I was the kind of guy that if I missed a shot, I would literally freak out. Like, I would take the pool stick and break it over the table. I would scream at people walking by that I didn't know, you know what I mean? And I would literally freak out, That's the state of being with nothing in me. That's sober, when I took my first drink, I was in a place just like that. I was in a club, and I was playing pool, and I was feeling, like the book describes, restless, irritable, and discontented. Now, I didn't have that language to describe that, but that's exactly how I felt. And the waitress started bringing over these drinks, and I had, up to that point, had a few drinks, mostly warm beer out of a keg at parties, in high school. But she started bringing over vodka cranberries, which, I had, to this point, never had. And I thought that they were delicious, And some might say that's sort of a sissy drink. That's fine. You could talk to me after the meeting. But, you know what I'm saying? I thought that they were very tasty, And they went down really easily, And I was just crushing these vodka cranberries, just killing them, dude, Playing pool, crushing vodka cranberries, And then the magic started to happen after about the third one, And everybody knows this feeling, where the room, the lights get softer, Like everybody, everybody starts looking better. You know what I mean? My hands start to get tingly, my palms start to sweat a little bit, and I start to feel good. I feel that warmth right here, right in the middle of my chest, And next thing I know, I'm just shooting pool, and I'm like lining up my shots, and they're just going in. You know what I mean? There's no second guessing. There's no anticipation. I'm just boom, going in. And next thing and there was money on this game because there was always money on my games. Next thing you know, I wasn't worried about who was going to win. And that's what drinking did for me. It took away all of that, It just really allowed me to relax and live life, Like, it looked like everyone else was living life, And it took away that fear and that anxiety and that restlessness. It took all that away. And I did not turn into an alcoholic overnight, I drank for about 10 years. And fast forward a few years, drinking's well integrated into my life. I was already going out to these parties and these clubs, and well integrated. I'm 21. I've got no parents. Like Brandon was saying, no one's checking up on me. I'm living on my own, and I'm going to the liquor store and I'm stocking up. And I hear a lot of people share how they were sort of embarrassed to go to the liquor store. I was not embarrassed to go to the liquor store. It's one of the happiest moments in my life, In fact, I would get excited about going to the liquor store before I even got to the liquor store, because I know relief is coming. And I would stop off at 7-Eleven. This is sort of 3 or 4 years into my drinking. If I had a job, I would get off work, go to 7-Eleven, get a super big gulp cup, fill it up with a bunch of ice, and about this much soda, So we're talking, just a little soda. And then I would go right to the liquor store, which was like across the street. And there was no shame in my game. I would get those little miniature shopping carts. I would just roll that sucker right in, And knocking over, the beautifully stacked cases of beer, to get to the good stuff, the plastic bottle, Smirnoff and the cheap stuff. And I just, I load up, man, load up. It's going to be a long weekend, And for me, the kind of guy I am, I'm not one to wait. I'm not a waiter. I don't wait till I get home. Like, got the liquor. I'm in my car. Got the super big gulp cup. We're ready to go, And I would pop that top, just the sound of the paper over the bottle, you know what I mean? Just brings back memories, you know? Just crack that thing, you know? And you can smell it already. You smell it, you know? And I look around, make sure no one's looking. And I start pouring it in. Look around again. No one's watching. Put the top on. Give it one shake. I mean, it's all liquor. You know what I mean? It's all. There's nothing to shake up. You know. And that's the get me home drink. You know. That's the starter drink. You know. To get me home. Get on the phone. It's a Thursday night. Maybe it's a Friday. It's usually a Thursday night. You know. And what's going on? Where are people going? Where are we meeting? You know, where's the party? And a guy like me, at this point, I mean, I know I'm in it for the long haul. You know what I mean? With a 44-ounce beverage in front of me, you know what I mean? I'm not shutting it down at 2 a.m., you know? For me, there's no such thing as last call. And if you're an alcoholic of my type, last call is a great indicator of who's an alcoholic and who isn't. You know what I mean? And, you know, I go out, we party, last call, people are kind of, you know, the lights come on, it's like, you know, get to see how ugly the girl was you were talking to and dancing to, you know what I mean? Everyone gets outside, and this is where it happens, right? This is the difference between me and them, you know? See, me, I already have a plan. I know where I'm going. I know where the after party is, you know? The non-alcoholic, or maybe the heavy drinker, says things like this. They say, you know, Chris, I would really like to go with you. But me and the girlfriend have got to go to Bed Bath & Beyond tomorrow morning. Do a little shopping, you know. Me being the alcoholic just listens in dismay, you know. And actually, I feel bad for them, you know. I feel sorry for them. You know, that's the level of delusion that I'm living in, you know. Or they might say something like, even crazier, they might say something like, I got to work on Monday, you know, and it's Friday, you know what I mean? Which is even crazier, you know. So, you know, and that's how my drinking was, you know. I would go to the after party, I'd party till 6 a.m., and I'm coming home in the morning, and people are coming to work, you know. And, you know, and I would look at them and I feel like you guys are suckers, you know, you don't know, you know, and, you guys got to go to work every day and work a 9-to-5 job. And now I had a 9-to-5 job, but I wasn't going to have it for much longer. And, because that sort of lifestyle is not conducive to the kind of drinking that I wanted to do. And, just like Brandon, I wanted to have a good time, you know, that was paramount. And, so things in my life started to suffer, relationships, jobs, things like that. I got to a point where I was basically unemployable, and I had to look for other ways to make money, because if you're a sort of a resourceful guy like me, you're not going to just because you are unemployed, I mean, that's not going to stop you from, you know, having fun, you know what I mean? So I started one of many businesses that I would start in my life. This one was not taxable, and the feds didn't like it too much, you know what I mean? And you know, and my whole thing is you know, I don't want to be a drug dealer. I'm not a drug dealer or anything like that. I'm just a facilitator of happiness, you know what I mean? And that's how I looked at it. You know, I just want everyone, I'm having a good time, I want you to have a good time for $25 a pill, you know what I mean? You know, no problem. And I had some fun, and it was ego feeding, and it was, you know, there wasn't a club I could go into, that people weren't lifting velvet ropes for me. It wasn't a VIP room from here to New York that I couldn't go into. And I felt like the man, you know. Really, the truth is that I was a loser and I was dying on the inside, you know. And it was only a matter of time before the house of cards would come falling in. And that's exactly what happened, you know. About a year later, you know, I heard a knock on the door, but they did not wait for me to answer, you know. And I come running down the stairs because I just ordered a pizza and I thought the pizza guy was complaining about the tip that I didn't give him. And I get to the bottom of the stairs and I look through the little window next to the door and it's, you know, ATF and SWAT lined up outside my door. And they kick the door in. I feel something cold and hard hit my head. And I come to with the DEA agents eating my pizza underneath their masks like this. Thanks, man. Thanks for ordering us a pizza. And it was awesome, you know. Awesome. And that was that moment, like Brandon was talking about, where I saw everything, you know, basically that was it, you know. And, you know, and I got locked up. And the truth is that, you know, I was totally delusional, you know. I was in there, you know, yucking it up with the guys in jail and, you know, look at me on the news, look at that, you know, look, I'm on the news, guys, you know, check me out. Really, what I didn't even think about was my family was also watching the news, you know. My family's friends were watching the news. My entire neighborhood, the people I grew up with, everyone that I knew growing up saw my name plastered all over the news. And I didn't think about that one time, you know. All I could think about is how I'm going to get out of here. And eventually I did. I posted bond and posted bond 10% on a $100,000 bond in cash. And the first place I went was the bar, you know. And I didn't think twice. The truth was, if you were to ask me, I would have said this. I absolutely need a drink right now. I just got federally indicted. You would need a drink too, you know. That made perfect sense to me. I never considered that I was, you know, that I had alcoholism, you know. That I was dying from this thing, slowly. And, you know, to make a long story short, I wish I could say that that was reason enough for me to stop drinking, but it wasn't. And the next year and a half would be some of the worst. I mean, I really hit the skids. And long gone were the days where I was going to clubs and I was the big shot. And, you know, nobody wants to party with somebody that's, you know, recently federally indicted, you know what I mean? It doesn't make you very popular in the club scene, you know? And I become like it says in Bill's story, I became an unwelcome hanger-oner and I was pulling in favors from everybody that I had helped out over the years. And I'm just sort of mooching off people left and right and trying to just get by. And I couldn't really stay out of trouble and I violated probation and I got a sentencing date, and you know, I basically had nowhere to go, so I checked into this one-bedroom basement apartment, and I paid 3 months in advance, and I basically started drinking myself, you know, in and out of consciousness until this trial date, and you know, and that's really where. You know, I felt those four horsemen that the book talks about, terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair. I mean, I really felt the total futility of what I was doing. And I knew that there wasn't anything that I could do about it, you know. That the only choice that I had at that point was to keep drinking to preserve my sanity, you know. And if you are here and you know what that feels like, to drink to preserve your sanity, and you're probably in the right place, you know. And that's basically what I was doing. And I just needed to get to court somehow and get sentenced. And it really started to look like, I know going to jail or going to prison doesn't normally seem like a bright spot for most people, but it seemed like a bright spot for me, you know, because I knew I was dying. And somehow I managed to get there, and I took a cab to my court date. I took a handful of Xanax before I went in for sentencing. And as soon as I stood up to hear what the judge was going to say, I blacked out. And I came to in a holding cell inside Circuit Court. And I tell you what, most people would feel a bit unnerved to know or to black out right before they got sentenced and to be incarcerated not knowing how much time they had gotten. I had up to towards 5 years that could have been given to me. But I didn't feel that way at all. I felt okay, you know. I felt like there was some peace, and that the madness for now was stopping, you know. And, you know, and that was really to begin my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I, you know, I started going to meetings while I was incarcerated. People brought meetings in, H&I, and introduced me to the Big Book. And I started relating, man, you know. I read the doctor's opinion, and I had never heard anyone describe alcoholism in plain English like that. I mean, it just was beyond me, you know. It's like, here is someone describing exactly how I felt and why I drank, you know. And I was pretty much sold at that point. And I had kind of, my head had cleared enough while I was incarcerated to really hear something. And I knew at that moment that if something wasn't going to drastically change, that I was going to be back in this place or worse, you know. And I had to accept the idea I could not provide myself with a solution to the problem I had, you know. And that's a humbling place to be for a guy like me. But I was totally hopeless. I was out of options. I had tried every imaginable way to stay out of trouble and to stay out of places like this and to not drink. And I could not do it, you know. And so I had become convinced while I was in there that that I was going to need to do something drastically different. And for me, Alcoholics Anonymous was there. I don't think AA has the lock on, you know, changing people's lives or even sobriety for that matter. But it was the right thing for this alcoholic. And when I got out, I got a sponsor right away, and we started going through the steps. And, you know, I took to this thing like my life depended on it because I felt like my life did depend on it. I made a deal with myself. I didn't vocalize it to anybody, but I said, I am going to do whatever this sponsor guy tells me to do, you know. Because clearly, I'm an idiot, you know. And the evidence was stack high, you know. And that was as clear as day to me, you know, that if I could have provided myself with a solution, I would have. I mean, no one opts into prison like, I'll go check it out. Why not? You know, see how the other side lives. You know, no one opts into that. You know, that's just what happened. And clearly, if I had a solution, I would have opted into a different path, but I didn't. And so I made a promise I was going to do what the sponsor guy told me to do. And do I go to 8:30? Oh, wow. Okay. I was shooting for 8:30. And we got started right away. The funny thing about my sponsor is he and I are really not, we're not that much alike. You know, if you were to see us side by side, I mean, we're two different people, you know. And but the reason I got him as my sponsor, and it took me years to figure this out, is that when I first met him, he told me his story, you know. He said, he basically told me how he drank, what had happened to him, and what he was doing today in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what intrigued me was that I could clearly see that he got the drinking game, you know, because he sort of talked that language, you know what I mean? And so I knew he was real about that. But what perplexed me is that the person standing in front of me was not the person he was describing, you know? I couldn't envision it. I couldn't connect the two. Now, what had happened that I didn't realize is that he was well into his eighth and ninth step at that point. So there had been a change. Something had changed about this person from a very, like, fundamental level, you know. Now, I didn't understand what that change was, but I knew that that was going to have to happen for me. You know, I felt like I needed to have that kind of change happen. And plus, he said that he tried snorting birth control pills, which I thought was crazy. You know, even I was like, "Well, I know that's not going to get you messed up, but I respect you for doing it." You know what I mean? So, You'd kill me if I heard me say that. We got right in the steps, and I started writing a fourth and fifth. I started writing a fourth step before I even got out of this sort of halfway house I was in. He was a smart guy. He wanted to get me plugged in before I had too much freedom. You know, I was in this sort of work release program, sort of like jail light. You know what I mean? And he was smart. He knew that. He knew he would get me working on something before I got out. For a guy like me that lives in delusional arrogance their entire lives, to look at themselves in the way the fourth step makes you look at yourself is a total foreign concept to me, you know? I mean, I wasn't out there with my friends like we just robbed this guy and took all his shit, and we wouldn't stand there and go, well, what does that affect? You know? What was my part in that? You know what I mean? And if you were asking those kind of questions around me, I would avoid you like the plague, you know? Because that's for an alcoholic like my, like for an egomaniac like me, any shred of truth about who I am has to be snuffed out immediately. I cannot afford to see the truth, because if I see the truth, I cannot continue to behave the way I'm behaving, you know? And to not know, sort of like ignorance is bliss, you know? I don't want to know. I don't want to know. Don't tell me. What did I do last night? I don't want to know. You know? Because I'm going to go out again tonight. You know? And so it's that kind of thing. And the fourth step shot right through that. You know? It's sort of like when you come to Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't know this, but you're in a dark room with no exits. But you don't know there's no exits because it's a dark room. So you're just walking around like, ha ha, yeah. You know, I feel good. I'm sober. And doing a fourth step is like someone turns on the lights and you realize you're in a dark room and no exits. And you're like, oh, I've got some work to do, you know. And that's the way the fourth step was for me. It wasn't a pleasant process. I felt better that I knew my sponsor well and that he shared some of his, you know, defects with me, and he shared some of his story with me. But I didn't feel good about what was written on that piece of paper, you know. I actually felt sick to my stomach, you know, if you want to know the truth. And I did like a lot of people do in Alcoholics Anonymous. After I did a fourth and fifth step, I got busy, you know, just getting shit, getting mine, you know. Got a job, got some money, got a girlfriend, and just living it up, you know what I mean? And Alcoholics Anonymous started to look not so shiny anymore. And I didn't even know it. I didn't even know it was happening. But the truth is, if you're an alcoholic of my type, there has to be something much more here holding you in place than just the fellowship Alcoholics Anonymous or the fun stuff that we do. A guy like me gets bored very quickly, you know. I mean, there's only so many AA dances I can go to, for the love of God. You know what I mean? You know, even totally immersed in Alcoholics Anonymous, I think they're unbearable, you know? Because I used to party at clubs, you know what I mean? I go to an AA dance, and you're like, this is late, you know? But that's looking at it from a shallow perspective, you know? And the truth was, is my grand sponsor said to me, he said, instincts on a rampage, balk at investigation. And I knew what he meant. And I had some work to do. I was balking at my eighth step, writing my eighth step. And I knew in that moment that if I didn't do this eighth step, that eventually Alcoholics Anonymous would not be enough for me. I have to leave. And this isn't, people think they have a choice in this. They don't. They don't have a choice. And in my home group, people leave all the time, you know. People leave all the time in all stages of their sobriety, you know. I don't know what that is. My guess is that I have a daily reprieve based on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. And that's it, you know. So what am I doing today to hold on to my sobriety, You know, not what did I do yesterday, not what am I going to do, but what did I do today? And so I needed to do something today, and I needed to do that eighth step. And see, there were some things on there I did not want to look at. And there were amends that I didn't want to make. Because to truly make amends, there has to be a massive amount of sacrifice of your time and attention towards a goal that doesn't seem like it's going to give you anything in return. You know? It just doesn't, you know. So I want to pay back this 30 grand. Why? You know? They don't even know about it. You know? And it's a lot of work. And people, unless you have this fatal illness, you're not going to do it. You know? Unless you believe that alcoholism will kill you, you won't do it. You know? And people don't do it. And they return to drinking. And I got busy making amends, and changed my life. You know, I started showing up for people in my life, my family, and you know, I was a guy. You know, I'm the only son of, you know, I have four sisters, so my family, I'm the only boy. My dad passed away of cancer when I was 14. And at his funeral, I did not shed a tear, you know. And I used to say, oh, well, it's because I was young, you know, and I couldn't handle that kind of stuff. But the truth was, is that all I could think about is how it was going to affect me, you know. That's how selfish I am. At my own father's funeral, I could care less. All I could think about is, how am I going to have to suffer now that you're dead? Thanks. Appreciate that, Dad. You know? As terrible as it sounds, that's what you're working with here. You know, that's the kind of animal I am. And so when I got sober, I had to make amends because I wasn't there for him. In fact, the day he died, family members had to come find me. You know, I wasn't there. And I wrote him a letter, catching him up on all the years that had gone by since he passed away. And I went to his gravesite. I went with my sponsor, and I went with a guy that I sponsor, you know. And I read that letter. And I tell you what, you know, there wasn't any bright, shining light, or the heavens didn't part, or anything like that. There wasn't any big revelation. But when I drove past that cemetery, I didn't have to look the other way in shame, you know. And it was the beginning of becoming the man that my father probably wanted me to be to take care of his family, you know. It's just the beginning. There's a lot of work to still do. And I started showing up for my family that still was around. And I started showing up taking care of my mom, you know. Making decisions with my life that included her, you know, and taking her on trips. Because I didn't want another family member to pass away without me being there. To live with that regret, you know, that's why we drink. There were a lot of other amends, you know. And I don't think you're ever done. You know, I owe a debt to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it can never be repaid. And that's the thing with the eighth and ninth step, is that it really frees me up with all that garbage. You know, not so I can, you know, have a better credit score or anything like that. So that I can take a new guy out and buy him some dinner. I'm not so broke all the time, spending my money on selfish shit, that I can buy someone a meal, you know? And that's the payoff, really, is that you start becoming a part of people's lives in a way that really means something. Taking newcomers through the steps. And, you know, I can't communicate it to you if you've never done it. You know, only if you've done it, you know what I mean. And it's that ultimate buy-in that I need in Alcoholics Anonymous to stick around, you know. It's that ultimate stake that I need to really latch on to something real here in Alcoholics Anonymous. And you know, I tell this story a lot, but you know, one of the great things about helping other alcoholics and sponsorship is that I got to walk one of the guys I sponsor through their amends with their father, and I try to make sure that everybody I'm sponsoring, they don't miss the opportunities that I missed when I was growing up, you know, that they're there for their family, and they don't have to make amends to a gravesite, and he hadn't talked to his dad in 10 years, not a word. And when he got sober, he started writing letters. His dad didn't want to talk to him on the phone, so he started writing letters. And eventually, his father invited him out, you know, to come visit. And I got to go out there with him. And I got to see him taking a walk with his dad for the first time. Get emotional. But, you know, you can't buy that. You can try. I don't think you'll ever get it. You know, you can't, you know, to have that experience. Drinking never did that for me. I mean, and believe me, I partied my ass off. And drinking never came close to that. And that's why I keep doing it. That's why I come down here, you know. That's why whatever AA asks me to do, I do. And you know, before I had worked through the steps in Alcoholics Anonymous and started helping people, I would have thought that if the best thing that Alcoholics Anonymous could do would replace the feelings I had when I was drinking, I would have been sold. Okay, that's a fair trade. I'll take that. You know. I'll do everything you ask me to do. That's a fair trade. But having gone through the steps, having helped other alcoholics, and been of service in AA wherever I can be, I know that there's no way that drinking can replace the feelings I've had in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now that is a major shift in perception. I believe that's the psychic change that's talking about in the Big Book, you know. Having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. And, you know, so I hope that if you're new tonight, that you can experience that too. I also know that it's going to take a tremendous amount of work and sacrifice, and that most of you will be unwilling to make it. And, but I'm excited about this weekend with Jack. It's going to be excellent weekend, and you know, and I hope you guys really pull out $100 and go, man. You know, I mean, I know I spent $100. I don't even know what I spent $100 on today. You know what I mean? I can't even remember. It's gone. That's all I know. You know, Jack's helped me a great deal in my sobriety. He's a pillar in my sobriety, and he does such an awesome job. And but anyway, thanks for having me down. Thanks for letting me share.